That said, let me tell you a quick story about a pastor who was meeting with a variety of his church members and leaders. This is about a pastor back from my hometown. It's a true story, I promise. Okay? And so they're all meeting together, talking about the new year. They're planning out their 2021, okay? And the biggest task for them in this meeting is to solve their big debt, okay? So they have a big debt they need to solve, and they said, we're gonna tackle this debt and eliminate it. And so as soon as the meeting starts, out of nowhere, an angel of the Lord appears, okay? This is a true story, I promise, all right? Just appears in the room, okay? And he says, I want to grant your pastor, all right, church leaders and members and finance team, I wanna grant your pastor one of three things. It's his choice, okay? All right, pastor, I want to grant you infinite wealth, okay, or infinite fame, or infinite wisdom. Pastor, what would you like? And the pastor says, without hesitation, I want infinite wisdom. Give me that. And so the angel says, well, I will give you that. And so instantly, the angel rewards the pastor with infinite wisdom and then disappears. And it's suddenly, this pastor now is sitting in this aura of wisdom. And he's just like, I am so wise. And then everybody in that room then looks at him, expecting some wisdom from him in that moment. And he realizes what he has just done. And some silence happens. And the lead elder of the elder board says, pastor, aren't you going to say something? And then the pastor realizes what he's done. He says, man, I should have taken the money. I share that story to say we continue our series through the book of Ecclesiastes. And today's continuation of chapter 7, we're actually going back a couple chapters. We isolated this chapter because there's a theme in it. It's all about wisdom. And today we're going to be talking about wisdom. And the reason why we're talking about wisdom is there's value in wisdom, all right? When you have wisdom, people come to you. You have some advantage in life when you have wisdom. And today that's what we're going to talk about. And I've heard from so many of you that you've really enjoyed just like the tangible, practical aspects of this series. And today is going to be no shortage of that. So it's going to be very practical, maybe even the most practical. And we're going to go through chapter 7, verse by verse, okay, and explain what each one is, all right? And so this verse is almost like a collection of tweets, right? There's these little individual phrases and statements and adages of wisdom that we're just going to break down. We're going to speed through some and then hang out in some. So just bear with me. But today is all about wisdom, okay? And so let me just define wisdom for us. And then there's a definition that I want to put up on the screen for this. A working definition for wisdom is a special capacity necessary for full human living, but one which can be acquired through education and the application of the mind. In other words, wisdom is knowing how to use what you know, not simply what you know. I know a lot of people that know a lot of stuff that aren't wise. And I know some moderately intelligent people that aren't very well read that are very wise, okay? So knowledge is one thing. The application and the timing of knowledge, when to apply it, when to use it, when to execute, when not to, when to sit back, when to wait, when to act, that's wisdom, okay? And the Bible calls us to be wise, okay, not knowledgeable, okay? We need to be wise. And the reason why this is a pursuit for us, because our big idea, and from what we're going to see in chapter 7, is this. The pursuit of godly wisdom protects and preserves your life. The execution of knowledge, okay, of this godly wisdom protects and preserves our life. And that's our big idea for today and what we're going to see. And listen to this. This matters for us. We never get past wisdom, okay? We're always in a pursuit of gaining more wisdom. How do we apply the things that we know? Because when we decide to follow Jesus, oftentimes we get a misconception that it was just a one-time thing. No, Jesus says to follow him daily, to take up our cross and follow him daily. And in that daily pursuit, it's yes, I believe in Jesus, right? But our life is made up of these small decisions each and every day. We're confronted with things each and every day throughout our day, and those small decisions and how we use wisdom or not wisdom, make up the Christian life. Do I say this or do I say that? okay? Do I respond with grace here, or do I respond with not grace? Do I satisfy the flesh now when no one's watching, okay? Or do I live a spirit-filled life and do the right thing when I know no one is watching, only but God? See, life and following Jesus is not this big broad stroke in one sense. In one sense, it's these tiny, mini decisions that we make that we need godly wisdom and spirit-filled wisdom and guidance in making. And so this is why it's important for us to pursue wisdom, because our life is thousands of these confrontations each and every day. So the pursuit of wisdom is something that we need to lean into, because we're going to be confronted with it dozens of times a day. So that said, if you have your Bibles, turn with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1. And we're going to literally read each verse. It's going to be fast in some areas. In some areas, we're going to kind of lean into the passages. And so we're just going to break down each verse and do that. Okay? Very practical today. Verse 1 of chapter 7 says this: a good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. The writer here is using the value of perfume, and in this context, in the time this was written, perfume was very valuable. It's expensive. It was a costly thing, and he's using this as a way to contrast the importance of one's reputation. He's saying your reputation is much more valuable than this very costly thing, all right? And the direct moral of this passage is true, right? When you think of someone of a good reputation, probably somebody comes to mind, and then immediately following that person that comes to mind are good feelings, right? You have good feelings of that person, right? And so this is the direct moral of this. It's good to strive for, to work for, to have a life of a good reputation. Dale Carnegie and all the other leaders that wrote books on how to win friends and influence people and how to leave a legacy, they're writing about biblical principles, okay? So it's good for us to apply that to leave a life that has a reputation. And the latter part of this verse where it says, and the day of one's death is better, is gonna lead into verses 2 and 3. Let's read 2 and 3. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, since that is the end of all mankind, and the living should take it to heart. Grief is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be glad. If you've been with us in the book of Ecclesiastes, you know that the writer here has a great way of being a drag, okay? This is another example of him being a drag and using pessimistic language to teach a point, okay? And this pitiful language and this sad language is a way to show us and teach us something through his despair, okay? And so what he's saying is, through his just pitiful way of saying it, it's better to have a serious outlook on life than just think life is a joke. That's what he's saying here. It's better, more wise, to have a serious outlook on life, to be existential about life. And so too, the latter of verse 1, it says, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth, is all a encouragement to say life is something serious to be taken. Like, life matters, and you should have a sober mindset when it comes to life. Not everything is a joke in life, okay? And his point is not to never have fun. We should have fun, but we should, in the midst of that fun, have a sober reality that life is short and death is imminent, okay? All right? That's not drag thinking. That's just a reality. We're all going to die, and Jake told us about that last week. And so it's better to think existentially than always be a joke. Verses 4 through 6. The heart of the wise is in a house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in a house of pleasure. It is better to listen to rebuke from a wise person than listen to the song of fools. For the crackling of burning thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of the fool. If you were with us during the Proverbs series that we did 2 years ago in the summer of 2022, you'll remember the language in Proverbs was littered all throughout that book, like the one we just read. Like, it's very similar. It talks about the blessings and the curses of living a wise life and the curses of living a foolish life, okay? And the big idea here is that wisdom and the people who receive wisdom, okay, are going to tend to be more blessed by the fruit of wisdom and pursuing wisdom, and they're going to have more blessings in their life by pursuing wisdom. Now, we talked about this originally in the study of Proverbs when we did this a few years ago. Anytime that you see a blessing attached to a pursuit of wisdom, or, hey, do this, therefore you might be blessed, or you'll reap this good consequence if you do this, what we need to see is these aren't promises, they're probabilities. And so when you see, hey, pursue a life of wisdom, therefore you'll be blessed, it's not a guarantee that your life is going to be perfect, it's going to be awesome, and you're never going to experience anything hard. It's talking about the probability of you living a blessed life. The probability of you having a good life goes up if you adhere to these, okay? You're still going to encounter things that are hard. You're still going to encounter unforeseen challenges or chaos in your life. But the probability that your life will be a blessing and a blessing to others goes up if you adhere to these, okay? And the heart of this passage, though, is a contrast between listening to the rebuke of someone who is wise that is offering good advice compared to listening to someone who is foolish that just is telling you things that you want to hear. And what the author is saying is it's better to receive a harsh word, which is basically a rebuke, that is true and helpful than it is to actually hear what you want to hear from someone that doesn't know what they're talking about. Okay? And when I was kind of processing this proverb, I thought of young people, okay? When I was young, and most young people grow through this kind of like teenage angst of saying, my parents don't know anything. I know everything. And this is what I immediately went to, is when I was young and in my teenage years, I said, you know, my grandmother who raised me, she doesn't know a thing. But now in hindsight, I'm like, she knew what she was talking about. And so young people, if you're in here today, what I want to tell you is your parents, as they share things with you, okay, they give you advice or say, hey, these are the best practices in life because I know better. They're not doing this because they just want to like wreak havoc in your life. It's because they really do know better. And so you live in a world, teenage or young people, where you're inundated with what you think is good advice, okay? Whether it's TikTok or social media or even the television, you're inundated with influencers and people that are trying to tell you what you want to hear. And they're telling you what you want to hear because they can capture your attention. And when they get your attention, they get more likes, more views, and it's just a sick relationship. They tell you what you want to hear so that you watch, and if they can get you to watch, then they're risen to popularity and fame. Do not listen to if the majority of the things that you listen to are the things that you want to hear, you're doomed for failure. You need to hear sometimes, okay, things that are hard to hear, because the things that are hard to hear are truthful and for your good. And the wisdom here is it's better to hear something that may hurt your feelings, that is may hard to swallow, but then preserves and protects your life in the long term than hearing stuff that doesn't protect your life, that is just foolish and that's just simply flattery. Influencers and TikTokers are not going to be there when the bottom jumps out. Your parents will, the people that love you will, and they may have something harsh to say, but listen to them, lean in to them, okay? And it's why the thorns crackling here is an important kind of image. I did some research on this. This is basically like kindling. So this stuff burns up really quickly, all right? And so too is the advice from fools. It doesn't last long. It burns up really quickly. Listen to hard things if they're spoken to you because they are there to preserve your life. Verse 7. Surely the practice of extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the mind. Essentially, this is warning us of the improper ways to use the tool of money, okay? Money is a tool. It's a good tool. It helps preserve our life. It helps pay our bills. It helps us be generous to people. Money is just a tool. At the core of it, it's not an evil thing. It's a good thing. But if we use money as a tool for improper things, it's a bad thing. Extortion, bribery, not good ways to use money. That's pretty simple, right? But the wisdom that I want us to see here is turns a wise person into a fool. Do not assume that if you're living a wise life right now, that 5 years from now that you'll be doing the same thing. The pursuit of wisdom, the pursuit of following Jesus is a daily commitment to him. I can tell you I don't have enough fingers and toes to count how many people I know in just in ministry, okay, that you would never guess would ruin our lives that actually did. That people were on platforms like this and were saying the most poignant things and preaching the best sermons I've ever heard, only years later and sometimes months later ruin their lives because they chose folly rather than wisdom. You can never assume that you've arrived. It's a daily pursuit to say, God, I need your help. My heart is corruptible, okay? And until you take me home, Jesus, I need your help to be pure and have a life of integrity. And so know from this verse that wise people can turn into fools. And so just be ready for that. Be on guard for that. Let's see, verse 8. Let's read that together. At the end of a matter is better than its beginning. A patient spirit is better than a proud spirit. This is basically saying it's good to finish things, okay? If you're familiar with StrengthFinders and this assessment, there's a strength that I have called Activator, which basically means I like getting things off the ground. I like starting things. The shadow side of the Activator is I don't like to finish things, okay? And so this is my weakness. And so when I read this week, I was like, man, this is speaking to me. I need to finish some stuff. And if you're anything like me, you love starting projects, but you may not know how to finish them. Like you get bored and you go to the next thing. The simple pursuit of this proverb here is to finish what you start. Or don't start things you know you're not going to finish. But here's the secret to finishing things. It's the key line in this after it says, a patient spirit is better than a proud spirit. To finish things, you need what? A patient spirit. And so here, you probably have a list of things right now that you need to finish. Well, the reason why that you have not finished that is because you've not had a patient spirit. You hit a roadblock and you just need some resiliency. A little attaboy, a little nudge. And today, here's your nudge. Go finish that list of stuff. And let me tell you this. It's not only the honey to-do list or the work project list, okay? There's some big things in your life, like finishing your will or restoring a relationship or actually finishing the thing that God told you to do years ago that you need to finish. So TLC, what is it that you need to finish, that you need to ask the Lord for a patient, resilient spirit to finish it? Maybe it's like you're a couple courses short of finishing a degree. You just need to go back and finish. Finishing things is good, okay? Finishing things are good, okay? Verse 9, don't let your spirit rush to be angry, for anger abides in the heart of fools. Simple. Don't be a hothead, okay? It's foolish to be an angry person all the time, and you're probably someone's coming to mind right now, okay? In the history of my life, everywhere I lived, I've encountered a hothead or two, all right? And every hothead that I know has very little friendships, okay? They've burned a lot of bridges. No one wants to work with them, and it's always someone else's fault, okay? Hotheads don't get very far in life, okay? They just move on to relationship. And what this is saying is don't be a hothead, okay? Work on your anger issues, all right? That doesn't mean that you don't have occasional anger. Like, I have occasional anger, okay? I can have anger. That doesn't mean that. But what it's saying is if you're continually angry, if your first response to everything is anger, you have a problem and you need to work on it. One of the perks of being married to a very smart woman, okay, is my wife, Lacey, who is not here today. She's with our two kiddos that have ear infections, and so I would love your prayers for that. But she is very smart. She has a biblical counseling degree, and she teaches me a lot of things. And one thing that she taught me about anger is that anger, okay, is not a primary emotion. It's a secondary emotion. You get angry because your first emotion wasn't resolved. So if you're disappointed or you're embarrassed or you're, you feel shame, if you can't resolve those feelings, the secondary emotion always is anger. And so my encouragement to you, if you're a hothead, you don't have really an anger issue. You have a self-awareness issue. It's like you're not aware of what's going on. And so if you're constantly getting angry about things or you're just angered about one issue, it's probably your primary emotion you haven't resolved. And you need to ask the Lord, hey, how do I solve this primary emotion before I let my anger get out? Does that make sense? Okay, let's go to verse 10. Don't say, why were the former days better than these, since it is not wise of you to ask this. I recently saw a phrase the other day, nostalgia kills. That's a bold statement, but I think the principle here is applicable. That people who live in the present, focusing on the past, wishing the past was their present, that is a foolish endeavor. People that are stuck on the past, the glory days, right? I think of Uncle Rico just wishing that he, you know, a coach would put him in, right? If you've seen Napoleon Dynamite, that's somebody living in the past, all right, that can't proceed in the future. And the past is good. There's great memories that we want to embrace. But if we're constantly thinking, well, just, you know, 1998, that was the key of life. I wish just today was 1998. We're going to fail, okay? We want to honor the past. We want to celebrate the past. But for us to have a wise future, a future of prosperity, we got to focus on how to make the future the best, all right? Don't live in the past. Focus on the future. Make the best of the things while you can and strive to create a better future by living out godly wisdom and holiness. Verses 11 through 12. Wisdom is good as an inheritance, as an advantage to those who see the sun. Because wisdom is protection, as silver is protection, but the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of its owner. Again, another adage of the blessing and benefit, the preservation of wisdom. Again, probability, not promise. If you pursue wisdom, the probability of this right here goes up. It's not a guarantee. So it's basically the consequence of this is someone who seeks wisdom. And my encouragement to you to gain wisdom is not only reading your Bible, but to have mentors in your life, to have people that are wiser than you, that have lived life before you have, okay? In your work careers, seek people that have been doing the job longer than you have to learn from them, okay? Put some people in your life to learn from, okay? Another thing that we need to do in terms of applying wisdom in this year, I want to encourage you to think about this. Wisdom also means testing things. It's not jumping to assumptions when current things happen in the world, whether it's current events or geopolitical events or cultural things. Don't assume what's being said on day one of whatever thing is coming out is actually true. If I've learned anything from 2020, okay, what we know now compared to then is totally different, right? And so what I want us to do, the wisdom thing, is not take everything at face value. Let things play out, especially where attention and chaos and psyops and all this kind of stuff is going to be vying for our attention. It's wise for us as believers to test things, to discern things. Hey, let this play out before I just assume what's being said to me is true. That is the pursuit of wisdom. Wisdom is sometimes waiting to see how things play out. And this is true in life too. Rather than just believing a rumor that you hear or a statement you hear at work or in your community or in your family, sometimes wisdom just says, let me let this play out. Let the dust settle before I make an action or say things. We need to not always react, okay, or respond to things. Sometimes we just need to wait. Let things play out and be okay with that. Verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can straighten out what he has made crooked? This is another way that all seasons in life, good or bad and everything in between, are God ordained and there for our learning and for our benefit. And what he's saying here is that there are times in life that we experience things that are just crooked, that are beyond repair, okay? That there's some things in life, I shared this with you a few weeks ago, that there are things in life that we'll just never know why they are broken or why they are the way they are this side of eternity. There's some things that we just can't control or fix. And what he's saying here is God has ordained some of those things just to be that way. And that they're there in our life to serve as a blessing, okay? And that's hard to hear. How does a crooked thing, a thing that will always be broken or just not repaired, be a blessing? Well, here's how it is for us as believers. Underneath the sun, okay, this is in context of underneath the sun, it does two things. One, it stirs our hope and affection for Jesus to return one day where he will restore all things and make all things new. And number two, it causes us to have deep dependence on him daily. It causes you to go to the one person that is not crooked, that is whole and holy and full of life. And underneath the sun, we're just guaranteed that things are going to be crooked. things are not going to be in repair. And so that's just the guarantee in life, and how they show up in our life is out of our control. But what is in control is a deep dependence on God, who makes all things, despite their brokenness, beautiful, because it leads us to him. Verse 14, let's read this. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that no one can discover anything that will come after him. I like how this one theologian described or commentated on this verse. He says, God balances out our lives by giving us enough blessings to keep us happy and enough burdens to keep us humble. Again, this kind of applies to the last verse too. Like, everything can't be a blessing, okay? Because we need to learn. Hardships help us learn things. Hardships help us stay humble, okay? And these hard things in life, everything in life is either a blessing or a burden. And these burdens keep us humble. We need a daily dependence on God, okay? If life was always peaches and cream, we would never need God, right? And these hardships allow us to see his goodness and depend on him, all right? Verses 15 through 18. In my futile life, I have seen everything. Someone righteous perishes in spite of his righteousness, and someone wicked lives long in spite of his evil. Don't be excessively righteous, and don't be overly wise. Why should you restore or destroy yourself? Don't be excessively wicked, and don't be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp the one and do not let the other slip from your hand. For the one who fears God will end up with them both. At first glance, you're thinking, okay, is this a call to live a balanced life? No. If you look at a balanced life in the sense of like, well, it says don't be too righteous or don't be too wicked. Find, you know, a way to, you know, be somewhere in the middle. That's not what this is saying. I had to do some reading on this. And the Hebrew words here, the verbs for this phrase of don't be excessively righteous and overly wicked, is not a command of to take that literally. It's actually a reflective one. In other words, what it's saying, if we took the real translation, is saying don't claim to be too righteous. That's what it actually literally means. Or don't claim to be too wise. In other words, to say oneself that it's basically, in other words, don't assume that you've always, that you've arrived. Excuse me, I'm kind of tripping up on myself. It's the principle is if you feel like you've arrived in life, like you've claimed, I've got this, I'm okay, I don't need to learn anything new, I know everything that's gonna come my way, that's the beginning of failure. So it says, never think that you've arrived in life. You don't have it all figured out. There's still mystery to life. There's something new that you and I can learn every single day as we pursue to be more like Jesus and as we learn about wisdom and how life works. And verse 18, okay, lends itself to this reflective nature. It basically says, it is good that you grasp the one and do not let the other slip from your hand. And here's the reflective nature. For the one who fears God will end up with both of them, okay? Don't claim like that you have it all figured out. Verses 19 and 20. Wisdom makes the wise person stronger than 10 rulers of a city. There is certainly no one righteous on the earth who does good and never sins. Again, these are more calls and pleas, encouragements to be wise, to seek the blessings. Again, probability, not promise. Verses 21 through 22. Don't pay attention to everything people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For in your heart, you know that many times you yourself have cursed others. In other words, people talk. And when people talk, you might hear some things about yourself that you don't want to hear. And people gossip. And so the call here is to avoid gossip, okay? Don't always be eager to hear everything that's being said about you, all right? And I love how one pastor, Charles Spurgeon, who's one of my theological heroes, put this. He was addressing a group of pastors, but I believe it applies to us. Here's his quote. He says, ministers or people ought to have one blind eye and one deaf ear. You cannot stop people's tongues, and therefore the best thing to do is to stop your own ears and never mind what is spoken. There is a world of idle chit-chat abroad, and he who takes a note of it will have enough to do. Basically, people talk, and it's best to ignore people's talking. Now, that's not saying that you never take criticism or feedback, okay? You need to take that. But if you're always listening to what people have to say about you, you're going to have more things to do than you have time to actually handle. And so it's just to be wise with your time, wise to who you listen to, okay? And take criticism and then spit out the bones. Apply what you need to do and move on, okay? That doesn't mean that you have to listen to every response that you're given. I have to learn that as a leader, okay? That I listen to a lot of people, but not everything do I have to apply. Because if I did that, we would never go anywhere as a church, okay? And the same thing applies to you and your perspective areas or respective areas. Is people talk, but it's not always wise to listen to everything, okay? Be diligent and pursue wisdom on who you listen to and how you apply it. Verses 23 through 25. I have tested all this by wisdom. I've resolved I will be wise. But it was beyond me. What exists is beyond reach and very deep. Who can discover it? I turn my thoughts to know, to explore, and to examine wisdom and an explanation for many things, and to know that wickedness is stupidity and folly is madness. What this means is that the wisest thing you could say in life, listen to this, the wisest thing that you could say in life is, I don't know. That's wisdom. I'm learning this daily as a dad of two girls, as a pastor of a new church, as a husband of 8 years. I'm actually learning as I live more life. There's more that I don't know than I actually do know. And that's the wisest pursuit that any of us can actually do in life, is that saying, I don't know. Some of the people that I trust the most don't always have the answer for everything. They say, you know, I really don't know. I need to get back to you. And the people I trust the least are the ones that are always running their mouth that are know-it-alls. And so someone probably comes to mind of that picture right there, the know-it-alls that always have an answer. It's like, I don't know. That doesn't feel right in my spirit. Some of the wisest things that we could do is just, I don't know. Let me get back to you on that. That shows in your wisdom a sense of humility. If someone is saying that they have an answer to everything, that is an indication that they are foolish, that they're not humble. And the root of wisdom is having a healthy fear of the Lord and realizing who he is and who you're not, and that there's some things in life that are just mysteries. And I want to just lean into it for a second. There's plenty of things that we'll never know in life, especially for us as believers, okay? In terms of personally and just how the world works and science and everything and culture, there's some things we'll just never know. And that is okay. That is okay to have some mystery to life. And I believe one of the problems in faith and matters of life and culture right now is that culture and society says this about life in terms of knowledge. It says, I understand, therefore I believe. I understand, therefore I believe. This is how people think and operate today. Like, I will believe it if I understand it. And a lot of people are moving away from the church because there's things that they don't understand about the Bible or God's nature or how faith works in real life and how do I live this out? This doesn't join up with the predominant thought of culture, and I don't understand that, so I'm not going to believe it. But here's the reality. Outside of that, there are lots of things in different disciplines that we don't know a thing about. Jake, who preached last week, works in science and does experiments. And there's a lot of things that he just doesn't know. As smart as he is, and his whole job as a researcher is to figure out things and to try to explain things of things that he doesn't know. And if you're in science, I think that's what most scientists say. There's more that we don't know than we actually do know. All right? And so if we take that principle and apply it to faith, okay, it applies to faith as well. There are a lot of things about faith, like the Trinity. I believe it wholeheartedly, but it is so hard to understand. And it's a mystery that we'll never know on this side of eternity, okay? There's a lot of things about our faith that require, that I believe in, that I don't fully understand. I don't fully understand the incarnational ministry of Jesus. How did God become a man? That is hard to understand, but I believe it. And so there might be something with you today when it comes to the matters of faith that you don't know fully, that leads you to having a hard time to believe. And what I want to just encourage you is if we look at other disciplines in life where they fully embrace and are confident there's a lot of things that they don't know, could we apply the same standard to our faith and still believe? That it is okay to have a full belief in Jesus Christ and the Word and still say, there's some things I don't understand. And your specific I don't know is probably coming to mind. Maybe it's the Trinity. I don't know how that works. But maybe today, rather than saying my list of I don't knows or a list of all the ways that I don't have faith, maybe we could spin it to a positive and say maybe the list of I don't knows when it comes to Jesus and faith and Scripture could be turned positively and say those are actually examples and ways for you to have faith. Because even though I don't understand the Trinity fully, it blows my mind. It is faith that leads me to believe it. And so what I want to say, maybe your I don't know is actually a reason for you to have faith, because then you have to run to the Father and say, I don't understand this, but in your ways, God, I trust. And so your I don't knows are actually pathways to faith. Does that make sense? We need to have belief even if we don't understand it. The same standard applies to other disciplines, and for us in life, the wisest thing that we can say is I don't know. And long for the day where we have full knowledge when we're with Jesus face to face. And we're gonna be faced with those things at 8 years old to 80 with a bunch of I don't knows. But we go to the one who has the answers and say, hey, I don't fully understand this, but I have faith that Jesus, maybe in time you'll give me some revelation to this, or just trust in my spirit that you'll answer this when I see you face to face. If you have some questions about that and your I don't knows, and if this wasn't sufficient for you, I'd love to chat with you after this, okay? And I reserve the right to say, I don't know. I'll get back to you, okay? All right, let's see here. When I go off notes, it's not good. All right, verses 26 through 29. I hope that made sense. Verses 26 through 29. And before I read this, I forgot to mention this earlier, but we're about to enter a hard text, okay? Or difficult to understand text. And what I want to just say is we're going to explain it. And the reason why I want to touch on this and the reason why we preach on the Bible is because there are hard things in the Bible. And we're all adults here, okay? And we're all just gonna, I'm gonna speak plainly and directly on the hard saying and the hard passage in here and just try to just make sense of it, okay? And the Bible, this makes me feel like the Bible is more valid. If it was just easy to understand, we wouldn't grapple with its mysteries. But this is a hard text that I'm about to read. You'll see why in a minute, okay? But I just wanna address it and say we're all adults here and we can handle hard things, okay? That's great. All right. And I find more bitter than death, verse 26, the woman who is a trap, her heart a net and her hands chains. The one who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Look, says the teacher, I have discovered this by adding one thing to another to find out the explanation, which my soul continually searches for but does not find. I have found one person in 1,000, but none of those was a woman. Rut-row. Only see this. I have discovered that God made people upright, but they pursued many schemes. Okay, a lot to unpack here. The first half of this is easy, okay? The second part is a hard thing that we'll talk about, okay? We don't avoid hard passages. We're all adults here. Okay, the first part is all about the dangers of being seduced by a woman. Okay, men, listen up, all right? This type of warning is all throughout Proverbs. There's a theme in Proverbs about being careful of being seduced by a woman, okay? It's whether it's the coworker down the hall, the neighbor in your community, okay? Or even the nameless lady on your phone that you can bring up quickly in a Google search when no one is watching, okay? We are all prone as men to be seduced by women. It's a warning that we, if we apply this, okay, directly to our lives today, that we should pursue purity, okay? That we're not always, we've never arrived when it comes to issues of purity. Like, we have to be on guard, be mindful of that, put ourselves in wise situations, create boundaries, making sure that we, our affection for the opposite sex, if we're married, is for our wife and for our wife alone, okay? We need to be pure in those ways. Single men, let me speak to you. Young men, if you're single. Before I was married, okay, I never thought that I would have to apply this principle when it came to being seduced by women. Even as a single man, I had to end some relationships, leave some friendship groups, because there were some married women in those groups that were making some advances towards me. And I was like, how is this happening? This is crazy. It can happen to you, okay? Same thing. They don't even have to be married. There can be women out there that seduce you to lead you to do things that you want to do. Now, I've picked on women, okay? Men, listen to this. The direct application for us, the inverse of this, okay, is this. Men, we too can seduce women. It looks different though, all right? And listen to this. We can seduce them through flattery, emotionally manipulating them, okay? And sometimes even some wicked men can prey on women that are emotionally vulnerable and seek them out and wear them down and lead them and manipulate them and seduce them to do things that they don't want to do, okay? Men, we can do this too. It looks different. Also, men, we can misuse our power and authority to get a woman's affection and lead them into physical relationships, okay? Because of that, we can seduce. It just looks different. And if you're a Christian man here today doing any of these things right here, that you're using seduction to lure women, you're online, whether it's dating apps or whatever, and you go from woman to woman to woman, if you're doing that and you're a Christ follower, stop. You're hurting the heart of the Father, and you're hurting each woman that you're doing that to. If you're seducing women by going on dating apps and taking them out so that you can get physical with them, stop. It is ungodly. It's wicked behavior. As men, Christian men, we do not treat women that way, ever. And so if you're doing that, I advise you to stop. It's not Christian behavior, and it's not something that honors your faith. You should have self-control, and you never manipulate women to get physical affection from them, ever. Stop. Now, for the hard passage. Verse 27 says, I found one person in 1,000, but none of these was a woman. Okay. This, at face value, is misogynistic language, right? Like, he's saying, okay, I've searched all over, I found one wise person, and it's not a woman, you know? What he is saying, though, is not that, okay? And so you've got to do some reading, some context, some looking throughout the entire book to say, what is he saying here? And at face value, you can be led to say this is what he's saying. But again, we have to apply the writer here, likely Solomon, is writing very pessimistically. He's writing probably tongue-in-cheek here, all right? And the other thing that you need to know is Solomon had 300 wives, okay, and 700 concubines, and so he had about 1,000 women in his life. And so maybe he's just writing this tongue-in-cheek because he's a little overwhelmed, a little frustrated, a little at his wit's end because of all the women in his life. And so if we take that, we can't take it at face value, but in the same sense, prior to him writing this, he said a lot of good things about women. He valued women. Let's read some of those. Proverbs 12:4 says this. Do we have it? A wife of noble character is her husband's crown, but a wife who causes shame is like rottenness in his bones. He's speaking of the value of women. Proverbs 14:1. Every wise woman builds her house, but a foolish one tears it down with her own hands. Proverbs 18:22. A man who finds a wife finds a good thing. Women are a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Next verse. Who can find a wife of noble character. She is far more precious than jewels. And last one, actually from Ecclesiastes, enjoy life with a wife you love all the days of your fleeting life, which has been given to you under the sun, all your fleeting days, for that is your portion in life and in your struggle underneath the sun. So we can surmise from that that Solomon does not hate women, okay? He's not like a woman hater. He likes women. He sees the value in them. And so from that, we can probably devise four different things from commentaries of what he's saying. The first one I believe that we can take, there's four things that we can interpret from this passage and what he's saying. Remember, he had 1,000 wives, okay? And so again, he's probably, maybe this is a sense of despair from him. He's overwhelmed with the amount of women in his life, and he's just making a hyperbolic statement about all the women in his life, and he's just saying, I'm frustrated with them, and therefore he says that. Okay, that's one way to look at it. The second one is, one commentator said this could be a reference to the context that at the time that women were not educated, okay? And so if he's comparing them, he says, I found one man and one of them wasn't a woman. That's probably maybe a reference to the lack of education. I believe this to be the least believable one, okay? The third one here, maybe a third explanation to this, is in a scale of what he is saying. Like he's scaling a principle that we need to see from his writings. He's saying first and foremost that he searched what? Within 1,000 people, okay? And only found one person to be wise, and it happened to be a man and not a woman. So finding a wise person in first glance of this is very rare in his estimate. It's like, it's hard to find. And so he's saying that means that there's 999 more men out there that are unwise. I only found one. And so at best, women are one thousandth less smarter than a man, if that makes any sense. He's saying men are just a slightly a bit wiser than women, okay? That's one way to look at it. And lastly, maybe the severity and the hyperbolic nature of this suggests that the application is the lack, therefore, not the actual generality of the statement. Maybe the hyperbolic statement is there to say, hey, wisdom is hard to find. And I believe verse 29 assures us of this. And this is the one that I believe the most, that it shows a hyperbolic severity of the situation. Verse 29, and we'll end with this. It says, look, says the teacher, I have discovered this by adding one thing to another to find out the explanation. Which my soul, oh, excuse me, 29. Only see this. And this is the thing that he wants us to put our attention to. I've discovered that God made people upright, but they pursued many schemes. Basically, he's saying that God set people out with knowing what they should do and what they should not do. And yet we've devised ways of doing the wrong thing. And so what that says to me is that that creates a hyperbolic sense that there's a lot of people that lack wisdom. And so that, to me, says that's the interpretation of that. It's a hyperbolic, extreme exaggeration that there's just a lack of wisdom in life. I've gone really over, and I'm sorry. So this is how we're going to land the plane. We mentioned earlier that the pursuit of the believer are these small moments in life of making decisions that are wise or not wise, that the summation of our life as followers of Jesus is not one decision that we made, it's countless decisions throughout our life. And so we need wisdom. We need the application of the Holy Spirit in our life to lead us to do wise things.